From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Pope Francis's visit to Turkey focuses new attention on the country's controversial presidential palace. The former U.S. ambassador to Syria explains why he resigned.
I could no longer defend the policy because the policy was ineffective and had no prospect of being more effective.
And a Broadway flop gets a second chance. It's all ahead. I'm Sarah Williams. The UN Refugee Agency reports about 50 people were killed by Boko Haram insurgents in Damasak, a town in Nigeria's Borno state, earlier this week. The UNHCR says at least 3,000 people have fled to the Difa region in neighboring Niger in fear of their lives. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Damasak reportedly was captured by Boko Haram 4 days ago. The town, which is in Borno state, lies just a few kilometers from the Niger border. UNHCR staff in Niger's Difa region report thousands of Nigerians fleeing from Boko Haram are arriving in a state of panic and desperation. UN refugee spokesman Adrian Edwards tells VOA people are being pursued by the militants right up to the riverbanks.
It's extremely dangerous. People are fleeing very quickly, very fast. A lot of women, a lot of elderly, a lot of children amongst those coming across, reporting real difficulties, families separated, children lost from their parents, people with no belongings at all in many cases. So this is, I suppose, it's battle displacement on the one hand, but with very serious consequences, obviously, for everyone affected.
Damasak is the second large attack mounted by Boko Haram close to the Nigerian-Niger border in less than 2 months. The first attack on the Nigerian village of Malan Fatori on October 5th prompted 1,000 people to flee. UNHCR aid workers in Difa say people are still arriving in Niger from Nigeria. They say most are waiting for boats to cross the river separating the two countries, while others try to swim across to safety. Adrian Edwards says local inhabitants report having seen some people drown.
The new arrivals are telling us that many civilians were killed during the attack on Damasak, especially young men. But the insurgents were also shooting at women and children. Some said they believe the attack was executed in reprisal for the enrollment of young men in self-defense groups, which have been formed to fight the insurgents.
The UNHCR says the regular influxes of Nigerian refugees and returning Niger nationals are placing a heavy burden on Difa, a remote and economically underdeveloped region. It says the remoteness of the region makes it very difficult for aid agencies to provide assistance to the growing number of refugees. Edwards says UNHCR, other agencies, and the local community are providing plastic sheeting and blankets to help people put up temporary shelters for protection against the nighttime cold. The authorities in Niger say more than 100,000 people have fled to Niger since May 2013, when the Nigerian government declared a state of emergency in the northeastern states. It says more than 30,000 people have fled to the area from Boko Haram attacks in the past 2 months alone. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The U.S. State Department this week condemned the ongoing human rights abuses and violations of international law in Syria. Singling out the regime of President Bashar al-Assad for blame, the U.S. statement said the continued slaughter of Syrian civilians further exposes the regime's callous disregard for human life. Since March 2011, Syria has battled against a range of opposition groups, and the country is split into areas dominated by various groups. In recent months, extremists from the Islamic State group have seized large portions of eastern Syrian territory, declaring the area to be part of its self-imposed caliphate, stretching from Syria into neighboring Iraq. Although U.S. military action in the area around Syria has concentrated on the Islamic State group, the State Department emphasized the Assad regime must be toppled if Syria is to reach a political solution free from violence. Former U.S. ambassador to Syria, Robert Ford, resigned his post in February and retired from the Foreign Service. He wrote in an op-ed in the New York Times that he resigned because he found it increasingly difficult to defend U.S. policy towards Syria. He's the guest on this weekend's Press Conference USA show and was asked by host Carol Castiel to further explain his decision.
I told the New York Times and told the American public that I could no longer defend the policy because the policy was ineffective and had no prospect of being more effective. The Obama administration says that it wants a political solution in Syria, a negotiated settlement to stand up a new transition unity government. That makes great sense to me. I think that is an excellent policy objective, but in order to achieve that objective, we will unfortunately have to put more pressure on the Assad regime. We went to the Geneva talks about Syria with Russia, with the United Nations. In January, we had one round of talks that completely failed. We could not get the Syrian regime to discuss a political transition. We went back in February, again with the Russians, again with the United Nations. This time, the Syrian opposition put forward a proposal in February that said they were ready to negotiate a transition unity government, and they did not require that Bashar al-Assad step aside. They said they were even willing to discuss that. Nonetheless, the Syrian regime again completely refused to negotiate a political settlement. So in order to go back now and try again, we have to do something different ourselves. We've tried twice in Geneva, January and February, both times failed. So we need to focus on the party which is refusing a political transition, and that is the Assad government. And the only way to get them to the table and negotiate seriously will be, unfortunately, to put more pressure on them.
Well, certainly things have changed dramatically for the worse, given the rise of ISIL, ISIL, also known as the Islamic State. But let me go back to question you historically again about your differences with the Obama administration. Certainly there were some people in the cabinet, notably former Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, former CIA Director Petraeus, and then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. They advocated helping the moderate opposition back in 2012. Mm-hmm. This was in early days.
Yes.
First of all, did you agree with those members of the cabinet that we should have, that is the United States, perhaps with the Friends of Syria, been much more aggressive in helping the moderate opposition? Why do you think President Obama rejected that advice?
Mm-hmm. I was in some meetings, but not all meetings. Secretary of State Clinton came to an agreement with the United Nations and with the permanent five members of the Security Council and the Arab League in June 2012. All the countries agreed, including Russia, including the United Nations, to push for a transition unity government, what I was talking about before with the Geneva talks. We understood, even in 2012, that it would be difficult to get the Assad regime to negotiate concessions with or without Bashar al-Assad. That's not an American decision, that's a Syrian decision. But in these Syrian-to-Syrian talks, we understood it would be difficult for the Assad regime to willingly offer concessions if it wasn't under some pressure. Mm-hmm. So the idea of helping the Syrian opposition in part was to get us to a fruitful negotiation. The second part of the reason to help the opposition in 2012 was that there was a rising extremist element among elements of the Syrian armed opposition. People who had come out of Iraq were associated with al-Qaeda, were beginning to call themselves the Nusra Front. This was before the Islamic State. The Islamic State then metastasized out of the Nusra Front. But we understood in autumn of 2012 that helping the moderate fighters with cash, with supplies, would enable them to prevent their people from crossing over and joining extremist groups. And in this effort to combat recruitment by extremist groups, helping the moderates would have been useful.
But do you think if the United States had intervened back in 2012 that we would be where we are today?
Well, I think it's clear we would be in a better situation today. I think had we been able to prevent so much recruitment by the Islamic State, had we been able to reduce, prevent recruitment by the Nusra Front, there would be less of an extremist element operating in Syria and in Iraq today. That's part of it. And second, I think perhaps we would have had more success in Geneva talks if the Assad regime was actually feeling more pressure.
Former U.S. Ambassador to Syria Robert Ford speaking with VOA's Carol Castiel. You can hear more of this interview on this weekend's Press Conference USA. Pope Francis called for an end to fundamentalism and terrorism through a greater interfaith dialogue based on all believers having the same rights. Speaking after a meeting with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Ankara today, the pontiff condemned the Islamic State assault on Christians and other religious minorities in Iraq and Syria. The Pope thanked Turkey for sheltering more than 1.6 million refugees who have crossed the border to escape fighting and brutality in the areas along Turkey's southern borders where the insurgents have declared an Islamic caliphate. Mr. Erdogan is hosting Pope Francis in the Turkish president's controversial new presidential palace, the world's largest and costliest residential palace. However, the Pope has made no secret of his dislike for ostentatiousness, which only reinforces the growing perception inside Turkey that the country's ruling AK party, which is rooted in political Islam, has lost its moral compass. Dorian Jones reports for VOA from Istanbul.
How Pope Francis, who has a reputation for shunning ostentation, will react to the palace is a question on the lips of many, say analysts. The Pope's visit is attracting renewed attention to the palace, which has become a symbol of the Islamist-rooted AK party's dramatic transformation during the decade it has ruled Turkey. In the early years, the AK party campaigned as the party of the dispossessed, fighting against corruption and waste. Today, explains Ishtar Gözaydın, an expert on religion and the state at Istanbul's Dors University, President Erdogan's platform is one of developing and building a new Turkey.
Obviously, there's a tremendous change. It has started from a very modest background, but now the point that they have come is another vision. That's how we're told, actually, the conceptualization of new Turkey.
But protesters have clashed with police over another development project in one of AK Party's key strongholds in Istanbul. The decision to destroy one of the city's last remaining green spaces to make way for a shopping complex and luxury housing provoked anger, even though the plans also included building a mosque. This old woman accuses the party of abandoning its principles.
Şimdi 90 yaşına yakın bir büyüğünüzüm ve buraya hayranlıkla bağlıyım.
I'm so attached to this land. It's a place for everyone, she said. The AK party was for the people, honest, pious and humble, but not anymore. Look where the president lives. But Turkish TV channels are inundated with commercials for luxury homes, consumer goods and the like. And AK party supporters have been among the main beneficiaries of a decade of unprecedented economic growth. A new religious middle class has gatecrashed a life of consumption previously enjoyed primarily by the secular establishment. Political scientist Cengiz Aktar of Istanbul's Süleyman Şah University says many supporters of the AK party and of the president in particular remain fanatically loyal.
Well, they are very proud of it. Some even think that it's not big enough, and they are happy to see that their president is having the biggest palace in the world. It's a very Turkish, you know, attitude, search for grandeur as the grandchildren of the Ottoman Empire and all these myths they live with, and they don't even realize that they are paying from their pockets.
But the White Palace has even divided public opinion here on the streets of Üsküdar, one of Istanbul's most religious districts.
Kesinlikle değil. Artık yani 1 milyar 300 eski para yeni para fark etmez ama.
It's totally wrong. It's a big shame to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on a palace when we have so many people in need of help, this man said. The palace is a palace of a dictatorship, not of a democracy. But another man disagreed.
Bence güzel bir şey. Aslında gerekliydi de açıkçası. Neden gerekliydi? Çünkü o saray artık
I think it's a beautiful thing and it was actually also necessary, he said. I think the previous palace was old and wasn't enough. Foreign guests come here, like the Pope, and there are other important occasions, so a bigger palace is more beautiful. After all, it's a palace, so what's wrong with spending hundreds of millions of dollars? The Pope's visit is adding fuel to the angry debate over the White Palace. That debate is likely to continue for some time, especially given the recent announcement that the palace is not big enough, and another 250 rooms will be added to it in the near future. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. Taiwan voters will pick city and county leaders in elections Saturday. If the ruling Nationalist Party loses seats, that outcome would signal that voters want change, including a review of the party's pursuit of deals with Taiwan's old rival, China. Ralph Jennings has this report for VOA from Taipei.
Voters across Taiwan will elect mayors and county magistrates Saturday in a poll seen as a barometer of popular support for a ruling party that has made a name by signing economic deals with China. Election losses for the Nationalists would make the 2016 presidential election easier for the chief opposition party, putting relations with China at risk. Ross Feingold, Taipei-based senior advisor with American political risk manager DC International Advisory, says China policy will be a factor even in the local polls.
Normally, one would expect a local election to be about local politics, but we know historically in Taiwan, elections are often made out to be about broader national issues or cross-strait issues.
After 6 decades of hostility toward Taiwan, China began negotiating trade, transit, and investment deals under President Ma Ying-jeou from 2008 as his party wanted more engagement. That dialogue replaced Taiwan's pursuit of legal independence from China. Beijing has seen self-rule Taiwan as part of its territory since the Chinese Civil War of the 1940s. Taiwan's economy has also gotten a lift from the 21 deals signed to date. The Nationalists are running tough campaigns in 9 cities and counties against the opposition Democratic Progressive Party. The opposition takes a guarded view on relations with China and advocated legal independence for Taiwan when it ruled from 2000 to 2008, angering Beijing. This campaign pitch from a truck-mounted loudspeaker in central Taipei is a common sound around the island this month as 19,762 people run for offices. Joanna Lei, chief executive officer of the Zhonghua 21st Century think tank in Taiwan, says the Nationalists must win Saturday to feel confident in their 2016 presidential campaign. She says China will be open to either winner.
If Tian Tiwu loses, you're coming into the 2016 election on the back of a really poor administration, low level of morale, and insufficient local support. So 2016 will be very difficult for TMT. I think mainland China has gradually learned that the best way for them to decide on which side to deal with is to wait until the voters in Taiwan decide.
The Nationalists are fighting against poor approval ratings for President Ma and sentiment left over from mass protests of March and April. Thousands of people occupied parliament and surrounding streets in Taipei then to oppose the Nationalist government's signing agreements with a historic rival, China. The president says those deals have brought trade, jobs, tourists, and investment to the island. Ralph Jennings, VOA News, Taipei.
Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein were the writing team that helped usher in what is considered the golden age of American musical theater. In the 1940s and 50s, they had a string of Broadway hits: Oklahoma, Carousel, South Pacific, The King and I, The Sound of Music, and then there was Allegro. Well, don't be surprised if you don't recognize that title. Allegro was a flop. Perhaps, according to one scholar, its concept and staging made it ahead of its time. But as Jeff London tells us, Allegro is back on stage in New York, reimagined for the modern theater.
In 1947, composer Richard Rodgers and librettist Oscar Hammerstein were at the top of their game, Rodgers told a radio interviewer a decade later.
If you're reasonably rational and have any objectivity, you know that after you've had Oklahoma State Fair and Carousel in a Row, this is a very good time to be cautious. This is when it's liable to sneak up from behind and hit you on the back of the head.
Allegro knocked them flat.
Brisk, lively, merry, and bright Allegro. Same tempo, morning and night Allegro.
The collaborators had helped usher in the modern musical with Oklahoma and Carousel, in which song, story, and dance were tightly integrated. In Allegro, they wanted to take those innovations a step further, as Oscar Hammerstein said in 1958.
Certainly in its conception, it was epic, conceived of a man from the date of his birth, following him through his youth and into his middle age. This boy had started as a country doctor and had then, through an overambitious wife, got mixed up in a kind of society doctor practice and was devoting more time to the social life that goes around medicine than medicine itself.
The deep-thinking gentlemen and ladies who keep a metropolis alive drink cocktails and nocktails every afternoon at 5.
The show was directed and choreographed by the acclaimed Agnes DeMille. It arrived on Broadway with a cast of close to 100 and the biggest advance ticket sales in Broadway history at the time. But reviews were mixed, and Allegro only lasted a season. Witnessing all this was a 17-year-old production intern, Stephen Sondheim.
What was interesting was I watched a lot of very knowledgeable people put on a flop. And by flop, it was a show that didn't work the way it was intended. It didn't work partly because it was a highly experimental show.
And highly influential for the fledgling songwriter, who went on to become the voice of his generation with shows like Sweeney Todd and Sunday in the Park with George. Sondheim cites the show's unusual song structures and large Greek chorus.
Maybe going forward is easier than standing still. Come on! One foot, other foot, now you can go wherever you want, wherever you want to go. One foot out and the other foot out, that's all you need to know.
In reviving the musical off-Broadway with a pared-down cast of 12 actors, all of whom play musical instruments, British director John Doyle focuses on the themes of Allegro.
It's a piece that's making a message about, I think, about the implications of certain aspects of the American dream. And if you want to follow your dreams, does that have to mean making a lot of money? In a world that values ambition, what does ambition really mean?
Claiborne Elder plays the protagonist, torn between the trappings of success and making a contribution to society. Elder says the bare-bones staging of the current revival serves Hammerstein's words and Rodgers' music quite well.
We are doing it in a very modern way, maybe, but we are doing the text that they wrote in the way they wrote it, and it's like that. The fact that it resonates today with an audience as being edgy and a little bizarre is pretty incredible.
And Rodgers and Hammerstein? While they were disappointed with the reaction to Allegro and vowed to rewrite it, they moved on. Their next two shows were South Pacific, which captured a Pulitzer Prize, and The King and I, which featured a half dozen hit songs. For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Rodgers and Hammerstein. They had so many wonderful shows, so much great music. Well, thanks so much for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
Nations dropping bombs, chemical gases filling lungs of little ones with ongoing